Tonight on Arena, Chris Whalley and Alex Murphy on season 4 of The Young Offenders and Hit Me Hard and Soft, the new album from Billie Eilish. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the program at RTE Arena. And yes, do turn on your computers, because with me live in studio and on the live stream are Chris Whalley and Alex Murphy. RTE.ie/arena. If you want to see Alex Murphy with a very fine haircut, it has to be said. And Krista, you have those headphones on, which you don't need. And people want to see that lovely curly hair.
I've got a very fine haircut, and Chris has a fine haircut.
Yeah, he has a fine head of curly hair, it has to be said.
I just opened my water here and it didn't crack, and I'm worried we're being spiked.
Yeah, the top of the jars.
The jars open. They're refilling the bottles in RTE. Yeah.
Have you heard of recycling?
Yeah. Big fan of recycling.
Well, you're not recycling anything in Young Offenders. I was saying to you, both of you, before I came to her, I watched the first two episodes of season 4. I'm not the better of this afternoon yet.
You're a bit shook.
Yeah, well, shook in a couple of ways. How immediately we were back into the world of The Young Offenders, even though we're 4 years on from, they're kind of a bit older now.
That's it.
And then how it did what it did before. It kind of had me roaring, laughing, and then little lumps in my throat and saying, what am I crying about?
I think Peter, the kind of main...
Peter
Foote, the writer of the show, he's so good at kind of just teeing you up for you're laughing, and then you realise kind of why the characters behave the way they are, and then you just... little tear jerker there at the end, so
yeah,
it's all the emotions.
It does, and that has been there from the very start. And I suppose we come in a little bit closer to the microphone there, if you would, Chris. In some ways, let me play a clip from the very beginning of episode 1.
Okay,
because this will explain why we don't see much of Chris after the beginning of episode 1. Let's have a listen.
Powder, I swear to God, boy.
Jock got an 8-year sentence in a Colombian prison.
Hands off me! The Irish NPC is going to hear all about this, boy.
Disfruta tu chucha la razón, gringo.
We knew it wasn't free holiday.
Luckily, I managed to make it all the way back to Cork. But I didn't quite manage to get out of Cork Airport.
That's just fabric soft now.
And of course, I should have explained before we went to that, the visuals there is that they're both.
So we got a free trip to Colombia on the grounds that all we had to do was bring over some heavy coats. You go, unreal, free trip to Colombia. But of course, the coats were filled with
and inevitably they bump into something that means that the packet's inside.
But I love how you just kind of have to, you have to suspend your belief. Connor's saying, oh, I made it all the way back to Cork. Yeah. Well, how did you manage?
I don't know.
I think there's a lot of suspension of belief in defenders, but that's why it's fun.
There are certain questions that don't need to be asked.
It's not Shakespeare or writing.
Yeah, and
it's just as good, but it's not Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
We go cracked though when we were filming that day with the dog, because initially the dog
This
was
in the airport, yeah.
Yeah, initially the dog was going to jump on top of me. And then I was going, I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with the dog jumping on me. And then... the dog handler was like, no, trust me, he's fine, he doesn't go, he knows exactly what to do. And so I was like, okay. And then a boom flew over the dog, and the dog just leaped and grabbed the boom.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think
scary dog.
And also, he was the same height as me.
Yeah.
So I was like, and I was wearing a big puffy coat, and I was like, you can actually go in there. Yeah. And then he didn't want to do that either.
They always warn you, saying, oh, there's a very highly skilled dog trainer, and the dog has been in many a film, and then it's just a rabid dog shows up.
Well, I'm sure the dog was very well behaved, and I'm sure his handler was right on top of things.
No, he was. He didn't want the dog jumping on him,
which is perfectly acceptable. But as that clip hopefully illustrated, Jock is in prison in Colombia.
He is, yeah.
And I've only seen a couple of episodes, and he's still in prison in Colombia.
Well, you have to wait and see. He's definitely going to show up. But yeah, I mean, it was only a matter of time before Jock ended up, before one of them wound up in prison. But yes, he is in Colombia. It opens up a whole new sort of world, which I think is a lot of fun. The dynamic is still, as ever, the same. And yeah, it just brings a new sort of energy to it.
Did you write that into your contract? I want my scenes to be shot in Colombia this
time.
Yeah,
he wanted a free trip to Colombia.
You know, they say Ardmore Studios is the Colombia of Ireland.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the reality.
It became Colombia. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Not quite the same, although very pleasant to be there.
Yes, yeah, well, we love Ardmore Studios.
But you were talking, again, I was saying about episode two, I can explain that in episode two, Connor is doing his leave insert. Yeah. And I was like the nervous daddy, you know, watching poor Connor.
I was getting PTSD because it wasn't too many years beforehand where I had to sit in my Irish oral
When we were doing the film, you had to keep getting out of school to...
Yeah.
We shot on the weekends because of you.
Yeah, this was finished, at the very beginning in the first season. I remember you talking about
that. No, in the film.
Oh.
When we shot the film.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I was finished and you were in fifth year.
Yeah. So I got Thursdays and Fridays off school, which I would like... Yeah, that explains my maybe poor leaving, sir. digits. But I'm doing all right. So.
Look at the pair of you now.
You're a man now, which you can prove because I get to keep my chest hair in this season. They had to wax me in previous seasons.
Oh, for you to be younger.
Which was always a highlight for me because I'd always go with him and watch him and record.
The cast would show up to the...
Oh, just for that, for the waxing.
Yeah.
New meaning to wax on, wax off, really.
Oh, isn't it?
But what you said, Chris, about you watched episode two.
Yeah.
Were you like me? Had you the big lump in the throat?
I mean, it does that.
We watched it together the other day.
Yeah, and it has those moments and you're laughing and then all of a sudden you just feel very emotional. Mm. But I thought that episode was very, very funny. And Danny Power...
Gavin Madigan. Gavin effing Madigan.
Thank you for that.
No bother, no bother.
But yeah, I found that episode very funny, particularly when Alex needs to go to the toilet at one point.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I like because the show has some quite highbrow humour. It does, but then it's not afraid to delve down into the fart and toilet humour as well.
Now, frankly, that's one of the bits I think that makes it so special.
Well, it's also, you know, PJ Gallagher, who plays the principal, who, you know, you have been his nemesis and he has been your nemesis as in Connors for four seasons now.
He has.
And suddenly he's kind of supporting you and looking after you.
So PJ's character, Barry's kind of in a bit of a bad way. He's been kicked out of the house and he's not the principal of the school anymore. So we're kind of on even playing fields. So he's helping me pass the leaving cert. And he does more than that in the end.
Yeah.
And you get to see some of PJ's tattoos again.
Yeah.
This is always a treat.
Always a pleasant.
People think they're stick-on tattoos. But
always a pleasant. But all of this, of course, is in Connor's ongoing need and love of Linda, who we need not go into too much. Gavin Madigan, or as you called him, Gavin
Beeping Madigan. Yeah.
Unfortunately, not in this clip. You don't use the beep.
Okay.
nor do you use the shortened version of the word.
Okay.
This is full on Connor as he expresses his undying love for Linda as he speaks to her post leaving certificate results.
Big Connor'll be waiting patiently because I fucking love you, Linda. Like proper love, the kind of love that keeps you going for 3 years in prison. The kind of love that Gavin Madigan would never understand because he's a selfish little prick. The kind of love that your dad clearly understands when he's thinking about your mom. The kind of love that your mom understands when she has a nice big glass of Sauvignon Blanc. Right? Yeah. The kind of love that nuns understand when they're thinking about Jesus. Like proper love. I waited 3 years for you, I'd happily wait 100 more. And as for the rest of you, thinking nasty shit about me just because I was in prison, fuck you all.
Yes, it kind of
I
warned beforehand that there was no shortage of the broad F in that clip for sure. That is from is it the second episode? Yeah,
that's episode one.
Is it episode one?
Yeah.
Oh yes, yeah,
so this the end of episode one.
Yeah, towards the end of episode one.
Rearrested pretty swiftly.
Tim was there that day.
Oh yeah, he was watching.
Then he didn't quite get the shot.
Your brother, Connor.
My brother.
No, your brother.
My brother.
It's a family affair. Oh, it's the nepotism is rife in this show. My dad's in every other scene.
And then my mum and dad watch an episode from season 3 last night.
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad's in it, but they didn't put him in the credits. He had a proper part.
So Chris, we need to get on Chris's dad, actually, Martin, is now suing.
Listening now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a real court case going on.
Way of getting money back from you.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, exactly. Well, he keeps on telling me that I'm a bad agent. And I'm going, listen, it's out of my control.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't start saying you're a bad actor.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. No, he tells me that too. It's okay. Yeah.
Now, you said that the pair of you watched, was it episode 2 you said that you watched together in your newfound domestic bliss as real life people, not as characters.
Myself and Honey here are living together again.
Who's doing what, or who's living in somebody else's gaff?
Chris is living in my gaff. Yeah.
And why is that? What's up,
I'm
Chris?
I'm doing a play at the moment. I'm in rehearsals for a play at the Abbey called The Sugar Wife. So I will be with Alex until the 20th of July.
I understood for a few weeks, and then on live on the Late Late Show, he told me it's a few months. So that's all right.
You might have to dupe him, or he'd never accept it.
You don't need to. Are you going to tell him about the run on the second play, or is that for another night? We'll do that. But however, you say The Sugar Wife, is that the play that the said Siobhan Cullen is
in? Yes, yes.
She was speaking to us from LA a couple of weeks back about Bodkin,
yes,
which of course you are in as well.
I'm watching as well with Chris every night now. Yes. I've been watching it, so
watching each other.
Watch everything together. Yeah.
Do you critique each other?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Because we know it's before bed, and I'm like, oh okay.
But yeah, Siobhan was in LA. She was doing the press over there, and I was worried that there she was heading off to the big blue yonder over in LA, and she wasn't come back. But she mentioned that she was back doing the play in the Abbey.
Yeah.
So what stage is that at?
We are in the second week of rehearsals. So I believe we open, and I could be wrong, I think we start previews around, opening night is the 18th.
Of and then June.
Previews, dates can be found online.
On the Abbey, but in and around the middle of June.
We're in the second week of rehearsals, but it's going very well. Very excited to be in the Abbey.
National stage.
Exactly. And to be working with Siobhan and an amazing play.
13th of June, I'm told, or actually that's the date for the previews.
Great, there you go. I must put it in the diary.
You put it in your diary
too, will you?
I'm just delighted to be working with Siobhan again.
And Bodkin, that must have been, did you get to meet the Obamas during the making of that?
No, I didn't.
He thought for a minute.
I
felt Jock coming up there.
He met the statue at the Obama Plaza.
Yes. No, Higher Ground had a huge involvement, and they were amazing throughout the whole process. And I believe actually Obama, Barack rang Will Forte, I just think yesterday or the day before, and had a conversation with Will about the show.
So Barack will be—he's staying with us then in 2 weeks, I think, before the 13th.
Oh, that's it. Why the confusion.
He's coming for the preview.
He's got the couch. Yeah.
look forward to hearing what he has to say when he's watching Young Offenders. The Young Offenders.
Of
course, you did get to meet Lenny Abrahamson clearly in conversations with friends. That was a pretty good experience.
Oh, he was such a dream to work with. I mean, he has no right to be as nice as he was. He was just I spent a lot of time just on set, even if I wasn't really needed, just to kind of watch him do his thing. Yeah. And it was all shot on film, so seeing how he kind of rehearses using that medium.
A different speed, I would guess, from the way you have to shoot The Young Offenders.
Yeah, because The Young Offenders, there's a lot of, we do a lot of takes, and there's a lot of improv, and there's a lot of coverage, but then for that it was very much more about just finding the nice particular moments in the scene, just the nature of the show, I suppose. But that was, it was great to work with him. Yeah,
of course, you're not short of your own big name directors, Chris, are you?
Oh, fuck. You tell me.
Interesting to see which big name director you would choose.
Oh God, I don't know. Peterfoot.
Early days.
There's the diplomat, the man who discovered me. But the other thing I noticed was a little flinch Alex, as I said, August Mila Buekas, the Marion the Hulawad engine. Yeah. And I saw Chris's eyes light up. Here we go.
Very proud of him.
Yeah, two things we have to say. First of all, there are whole sections of episode two, which are Asqueliga.
Yeah.
But to drama ella genta, which a genta anish, which a creek now.
Yeah, we have made over to Guidor.
Guidor, yeah.
Nolug shukata. Agus níl mé lifa anish, agus, you know, I'm trying.
Well,
my Irish when we shot it last year, in episode two for the Irish Oral was pretty close to what my Irish was, and then I had a few months prep before starting this gig in Guidor.
It's an Irish language. It is.
So it's a bit of a kind of crime drama, and I'm on the other side of the law this time. But I had a good team. Padder Cox from Glanmire, he was my Irish teacher.
I didn't know he's from Glanmire.
There you go. So yes, you have that to look forward to now.
Arena's a very, very informative programme on a nightly basis.
Oh yes.
Even when you're sitting in the chair, you find something new.
I won't miss an episode ever again.
But how did you find working on Asqueliga?
Yeah, it was 9 weeks in Guidor. And just talking Irish every day, just a real newfound love for it. Because in school, you kind of, shamefully, I just didn't care. I didn't know why I should care. And then when you're kind of working in the Gaeltacht, and I really have a new love for it now, and I know why it's important. And I love doing it. So I hope to keep it up.
Yeah.
I was saying earlier, I feel like they should just show us all the wind that shakes the barley when you're in first year, and then we'd all be like, I'm doing Irish.
I'm doing Irish. I'm going to win an Oscar.
Those are my two things.
Yeah. Cillian Murphy, of course. Proud Cork people, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
When that happened. Yeah.
Cillian likes the show, I heard. That's pretty good. So he'd want to.
He does.
And this move now, because it was on BBC Three, but now it's going to be on BBC One. I mean, that's.
Oh, yeah, mad. Oh, it's just so hard to believe that, the show. The film was just such a no budget thing, and then when the BBC kind of came on board, and just to see it kind of climb now it's prime time BBC One. It's mad.
Yeah, because BBC Three, I suppose, is
it's more the online kind of aspect.
But BBC One is full terrestrial, full there. And I wondered about that aspect of it, because obviously the Gaeltacht is subtitled, which probably needs to be subtitled for some people here at home. Let's be honest, but. How do you think, Chris, that the very Corkonian aspect of this, obviously it's sitting okay with the British audience, but why does it do that, do you think?
I think Jock and Connor are just relatable to everyone. I think it's a universal story about friendship and about lads just getting up to mischief, you know, and harmless mischief, really. They have good hearts and good souls, and they make mistakes, and then they ultimately learn, and then they forget. They start all over again.
Yeah.
You know, it's a cyclical nature, a narrative nature that I think Peter is so good at writing, and I feel like there are a lot of lessons in it as well. It has a message every episode, which I think is, like you say, why it gets suddenly emotional, and I think that's the beauty to it. You know, it makes you laugh, and then within seconds it can turn that. And I just think it's universal. And I think language...
People like putting a magnifying glass up to very particular cultures as well.
Which
it is a culture. Like, the Cork has its own culture and different bits of Ireland and stuff. And the show is very good at being very specific with that. It's all very... All the extras are, you know, background actors are all Cork. And a lot of the actors in it too, their aim isn't to be actors. They enjoy doing the show.
Yeah.
And they're kind of called back for every season, and they love doing that.
Yeah.
But I think that's what makes it quite local. And
true. Yeah.
And I suppose it's the oldest thing in the book, isn't it? The more specific you are, then the more universal you are.
Yeah.
You know?
The BBC are very good at letting us kind of do our own thing.
Yeah.
This season, I had to go into a booth and kind of remove a few F words. We outdid our quota by a few dozen.
You kind of gave us our quota for about 3 weeks in a 43-second clip.
You're welcome.
Don't think we've said one yet. Go on, go for it.
No. As the characters, it is perfectly fine. As the actors, I much rather it when you do the shortened version.
My mum had a heart attack.
That you give to us earlier on. There is one other scene that I wanted to talk a little bit about in episode two, which is because it touches on that whole thing of the Leaving Cert. Mm. And because it's such a big thing in Irish life. Anybody yeah. who's been through secondary school knows what it is. There are a number of, and I'm making inverted commas now up right. in the air, RTE news clips of interviews of people on the street.
Yeah.
How did they... Are they actual clips or what? Because they seem very real.
They're a bit too real. I think the people maybe didn't know that it was the Young Offenders filming them, our own film crew. But no, I think they were just people on the street that agreed to be in the show. Although there's a few kind of family friends that I think were drawn in.
Was your father? Was he asked again here, Chris?
Yeah, Pascal's actually in it, who was the farmer in the film.
Yes, we say hello to Pascal Scott.
Yes, Pascal Scott. Pascal. But God, everyone has their own story of the Leaving Cert. It's just such a traumatizing time.
I genuinely still wake up occasionally from fear of not having like studied or, and I just went, I never had to study really for anything again after school. So it's always rooted back to the Leaving Cert.
Yeah.
There was lots of people those kind of anxiety dreams. You're going in and it's either you've got the wrong paper or you're going in. I thought it was English.
But it's amazing when you wake up and you're like, I'm an actor. I don't have to do anything.
You have to look as if you don't do anything.
My parents were always grown up. They were like, you can learn your lines, no bother. Why can't you learn the biology book? Because I don't care about the biology.
Listen, guys, I could talk to you for the entire evening, but there are a few other people I want to talk to as well.
Cancel it.
Listen, thanks a million for coming in. Continued success to both of you. Looking forward to hearing. What's it called? Search and Awoke is the drama and the Sugar Wife. Is that the
Sugar Wife
in the Abbey? Great to see you both, Chris Wally, Alex Murphy, and The Young Offenders continues on BBC One tonight at 9:30. Anyone who follows Olivia Lang on social media will know what a keen gardener she is, just as anyone who reads her memoirs will know she studied botany for some years with a view to becoming a herbalist. Olivia is also the author of the award-winning novel Crudo, but has written six hybrid works of criticism, biography, memoir, including the best-selling The Lonely City, and, when we last spoke in 2021, the book Everybody. Perhaps it was only a matter of time before she turned to the garden. Her new book, The Garden Against Time, is its title. And in it, she details the restoration of the garden of a house she moved to in Suffolk in 2020 and explores related concepts along the way, from Milton's Paradise Lost to the garden of artist Derek Jarman, created on a shingle beach in Kent. Delighted that Olivia Lang joins me on the line this evening. Olivia.
It's lovely to be back. Hello.
Great to have you here as well. How long have you been waiting to write this book about gardening? Has it been, I'm all the puns I'm trying to avoid, but I presume it has been germinating there for a long time.
It has long roots in my life. I would say 47 years. I think since the moment I came into the world, this is the book I wanted to write.
And where did that love of gardening come from? And it's more than just you like planting flowers and they grow. There's more to it than that, a lot more.
I think I'm a bit of an obsessive gardener, but also I'm an obsessive reader of garden books. I'm very interested in garden history. Yeah, the whole thing. My dad was a very keen gardener. And when my parents divorced, the way that he spent his weekends with us was to just drag us around stately home gardens. And at first we liked having the ice cream or the cream tea, but we gradually started to get indoctrinated. So I think it really starts there.
Yeah, so you give up on saying, please just bring us to McDonald's. Can you not just do that on Saturday?
Where are the stickers?
So that kind of early grounding in those stately houses, they're interesting gardens in general terms when you look at the gardens of stately houses, because they obviously speak to a great inequality in many ways in the world. The fact that you can have a stately house with a stately garden that has been landscaped and perfectly manicured from you tells us something about who you were, as in the person who owned that garden originally.
Absolutely. And part of what I wanted to unpick with this book is the history of exploitation and exclusion that is kind of stitched right in, baked right into the history of the stately house garden. So I wanted to look at things like the enclosures, the process by which common land was seized by the very wealthy and turned into their sort of great capability brown parklands. And I also wanted to look at the legacy of colonial slavery, the way that the money came from slavery in the West Indies and America, comes back to England, and is sort of goes through this strange cleansing process where it's turned into beautiful gardens that make their owners seem as if they are honourable members of the aristocracy. And I wanted to really expose where that money was coming from and what kind of pretty horrific work it came out of.
Of course, I mean, in very simple type of amateur psychoanalysis, if the garden of your stately home is perfect, with the borders perfect and every plant blossoming at the perfect time in perfect rows, you can be pretty sure that there's a mess somewhere else in your life.
I think that's a very good way of putting it, actually. Yeah, that's the whole thing in a nutshell. Something else is going on. There's something dark at the heart of that. And I really wanted to sort of slice through the perfection and ask what kind of cost it had.
And I'm interested in the nature of your recurring dream, which is how the book starts, in fact. You tell us this dream that you've had on a number of occasions, I think, maybe numerous occasions, is it?
It is.
And explain the garden that you dream about.
Yeah, I think this is really a dream of Generation Rent, and I was part of Generation Rent until I was 40. So it's a dream. It's a version of the dream where you go to your house and you find a whole set of rooms that you didn't realize were there. But in my dream, it's that I open a door into a garden I didn't know was there, and suddenly I find myself in this totally unexpected space. And the gardens are often very beguiling, but always kind of overgrown. And it's a dream I've had on and off throughout my life. And a lot of that time, you know, I was living in housing insecurity. I didn't have gardens.
Hmm. And you know, you talk about the gardens quite often in the dreams would be overgrown, but in the wonderful way that dreams allow us to have such thoughts and such feelings, somehow you know that within that overgrowth there are precious secrets hidden, but not because they have to be kept quiet. They're just, you have to uncover them, and also there's great fecundity within it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the strange thing, is that that's the garden that I discovered in 2020 when we started to look. I found this amazing enclosed lost garden.
Yeah, I suppose this garden is kind of, it's where you live there right now, don't you?
I still live there. Yes. I still live there. So, yes, I'm on the road at the moment, but I do live there.
So am I saying his name right? Mark Rummery.
Mark Rumory, I think, Rumory is how people in the village say it. So I'm trusting them.
Well, they might know better than I would, that's for sure. So you might explain who he was and the nature of the garden that he made in this house.
I will. So he was the head designer at Knotcuts, and they were a Suffolk nursery that I'd come across actually over the years, because they used to do beautiful displays at Chelsea. They were famous for their Chelsea Flower Show displays. And Mark worked there. He did all kinds of stately home gardens. He worked for royal families in Jordan. He did various projects. He was involved in Monet's Giverny. And he made one garden for himself. He lived in this house that we now live in Suffolk from the 1960s until 2010, when he died. And he made this very beautiful garden. It's a third of an acre. So it's not a gigantic plot at all. And he divided it up with hedges, with walls, there are little archways. So you're constantly in very small spaces. They're very intimate. They're full of rare plants. And they have this feeling of incredible seclusion and mystery. But when I saw it for the first time, just before the pandemic struck, it was a garden out of time. It was like the secret garden. It had been reclaimed by ivy. It was full of bamboo. You could see that there were beautiful things in there, but it was also kind of going to rack and ruin.
Why do you think, Rumory, you talked about this need for seclusion and secrecy? He unfortunately did have to keep aspects of his life secret in his time.
He did. He was gay, and people in the village really made a point of telling me that. And I don't think they were homophobic. I don't think they were telling me that in a pejorative way. I think they were actually being protective, and that they were worried that I might be shocked by it, which obviously I wasn't. My mum was gay, so I was the perfect person to take on his house and that kind of legacy. yeah, so that was it really started off this kind of train of thought about why some people might want or might need a garden of seclusion, why that kind of privacy might have been very important to some people.
And obviously his gayness and the fact that it was a criminalized activity in his time was part of that reason for his secrecy. But it also is a place of great healing and soothing. And the fact that this book is, it in some ways, I think it is a product of COVID. And in fact, many people's love or newfound love or rejuvenation of a love in gardening comes from that period in time, the COVID period. How did that feed into the writing of the book?
Yeah, gardening went absolutely crazy. Something like 3 million people started gardening for the first time in the pandemic in the UK, most of them millennials. And the same pattern is all over the world. We saw it in India, we saw it in Italy, we saw it in Russia, we saw it in America. So there's this real sense that people were turning to gardening. So that was, you know, very much the kind of mood that I was in. But at the same time, I think what the pandemic underscored was that it was unequal. Some people spent the pandemic in beautiful surrounds, sitting in their deck chair, sharing pictures on Instagram, and other people didn't have access to gardens at all. And so I think that really, you know, I'm a political person anyway, I write very political books, but I think that really pushed me to look at the ways in which our sort of dream of Eden, our dream of green space, has a lot to do with exclusion and how that can be changed.
Yeah, it was extraordinary how we suddenly became aware, if you were lucky enough to be living in a home where you had your own green space, or even in a 2 kilometer area, as it was for us at one point in time, that if there were green spaces within that 2 kilometer area, you suddenly realised how essential those things were to your own well-being. And sympathy for those who didn't have them, empathy perhaps for those who didn't have that type of space, was, I think, quite a profound wake-up call for many people.
I think that's absolutely true. And that really is the sort of mood that underlines the book. It's funny because I would never have said, oh, I'm writing a pandemic book, I'm trying to keep a pandemic diary. But actually, I think you're right that it did end up being a pandemic book, because it's like the clock of the lockdown after lockdown. All of those things that happened in that 2 year period are kind of caught in amber in the book.
Yeah, they are, very much so. But as you said, lots of people did turn or return to gardening during that period in time. Of course, you went back to, is it the mother or the father or the parent of all gardens? I don't know how to describe it. You bring us back to the Garden of Eden, but you bring us back there, I suppose, via Paradise Lost and John Milton. You sat down to decide to read Milton's poem during that period of time.
I did, and I am here to tell you that it was one of the best reading experiences I ever had. And if anyone's ever thought about reading Paradise Lost and has felt intimidated as I did for many decades, it was an absolute ride. It was fantastic. It was such an exciting book because, you know, it's like the invention of cinema. There's Satan and he's trapped in hell and he's trying to get into Eden and he's breaking in and he's climbing over the wall. It's so dramatic. The language is amazing. It's very rich. So it was an extraordinary experience.
Did you read it out loud? I'm just interested to know. Or are you a silent reader of poetry?
All right, I did. I did sometimes read it out loud. Yeah, I think my husband could hear me muttering upstairs.
He, of course, being the poet himself. Did he join? Yeah. I mean, did you start to play parts? One of you being Satan, one of you being some of the other angels?
Now I feel like we could have spent the pandemic much better.
you can revisit in the reading of Paradise Lost. I mean, possibly now you can recollect it. You know, in hindsight, how did it inform your attitude to gardening and to the garden as a, I suppose, an archetypal space in a new type of way?
Yeah, but I think one of the most interesting things was realizing Milton's own situation as he was writing it. You know, we've had a difficult few years with things like Trump, with things like the rise of the far right. It's felt often as if the dreams of the 20th century are being destroyed. And to realize that Milton wrote that book in the midst of the shift in the Civil War, from he'd been victorious, his side, the Republicans, had won, to they were losing, the Royalists were returning, they were coming back into London, he was at grave risk of execution. And in that moment, he starts to dream of Eden again. He starts to lay out what he thinks the perfect utopia is. And I think there's a real lesson in that for all of us right now, faced with climate change, faced with so many really dismal changes in the world, the desire to dream of Eden and to be very specific about what it is we want is the first step to getting it, I think.
Well, I will finish by asking you what your Eden, what your utopian garden is. But before we go there, I do want you to speak to me briefly about Derek Jarman's garden. And I was thinking, people think, did he say shingle? Did he meet single? No, I did mean created on a shingle, a shingle beach in Kent. Explain that garden to us and why it's part of the book for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So Derek Jarman, the filmmaker, the artist, the writer, made this garden in the 1990s after he'd been diagnosed with AIDS. And at the time, there was no cure for AIDS. There was no treatment. So, I mean, there was treatment, but the treatment was very toxic. So he knew he was dying. And faced with that, what he did, it's very Derek Jarman. He made the most exuberant and beautiful garden in, frankly, impossible circumstance. It's on a shingle beach. It has cutting winds laden with salt, so it's not promising ground for planting. And yet he dug holes, he filled them with manure, he planted his rare roses, and he made this desert blossom. And it just had to be in the book. Yeah. I tried not to put it in the book because I felt I'd written about him a lot, but in it got.
It had to be there. So to finish then, Olivia, if you would, your utopian garden. And there are aspects of this that I love, not least of which is it is both cultivated and wild.
Both cultivated and wild, and absolutely for me, a combination of the private garden and the public garden. I think we need a massive investment in public gardens. We know that they help physical health. We know that they help mental health. We know that they reduce heat in cities during droughts and periods of heat wave. They really offer for me so much potential for the future. So I want to see, you know, our urban environments transformed into glorious flowering, amazing utopias in exactly the same way that Jarman induced the desert to flower.
Well, sold to the man at the back, and I will be going out to my garden out to my garden tonight when I go home, because now I suddenly feel I have to go out and look at it again. Olivia, lovely to speak
with
you. Yeah, exactly. Lovely to speak with you, and thanks for being with us this evening.
A pleasure.
That's Olivia Alang. The Garden Against Time is the title of her new book. It's published by Picador. And Olivia will be at the International Literary Festival of Dublin, 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 21st of May. And that should be an interesting conversation for sure. You'll find out full details on ilfdublin.com. And so to our album reviews, just two for you on this Friday evening, but what a pair they are. The first is Hit Me Hard and Soft, third studio album from global superstar Billie Eilish. How much has she achieved since the release of her studio debut, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? That was in 2019. Now at 22, she has two Academy Awards for Best Original Song for the Bond film No Time to Die, more recently Barbie. Along with her Oscars, she has received an array of Brit Awards, Billboard Awards, MTV VMAs, two Guinness World Records, not to mention the 9 Grammys she received, making her the youngest person and the first female artist to win the 4 main Grammy Awards, Best New Artist, Record of the Year, Song of the Year and Album of the Year. It's time for all of us to go home now. And we're going to deign to review her album. Well, anyway, that is what she has achieved. And then, career spanning over 3 decades, Devon songwriter Beth Gibbons provides us with our second album, her debut solo album. It's called Lives Outgrown, former vocalist of the legendary 90s band Portishead. And of course, we will see what she does when she's working by herself with a few pals, I'm sure, helping her along. Let us start with Billie Eilish and the track Skinny. Opening track on the new Billie Eilish album, the album being Hit Me Hard and Soft, the track being Skinny. I didn't say that it was Dave Hanratty and Zara Hanratty and Zara Hederman who were with me in studio this evening, but indeed it is the pair of them that are here with me. That song Skinny, it's such a beautiful ethereal vocal sound, and you think, there's nothing nasty in there at all, but she's speaking about very serious topics in there. You have the exact quote of the part of the lyric that contains the word skinny in it, Zara.
Yeah, it says 21 took a lifetime, people say I look happy just because I got skinny, but the old me is still me and maybe the real me. And that as an opener reminded me immediately of the opener of her previous album, Happier Than Ever, Getting Older, where she talks about things I once enjoyed just keep me employed now. And that album was her kind of, I hate fame, but talking about how fame has like affected her life, the cost of fame. Because a lot of her fan base would look at her, see how successful she is, see how influential she is, and aspire to that kind of status in life. And she is actually one of the few who is very openly and frankly talking about, actually, this life is not an easy one, and it's not one she takes gladly.
And she has navigated that, I think, with great skill and aplomb, and to my mind presents a wonderful role model to any young person.
Which is really interesting, because there's this incredible interview that she did with Rolling Stone in the last few weeks, which ends with her saying that she doesn't want to be a role model. She doesn't want to be a role model for mental health. She doesn't want to be a role model to anybody at all. She just wants to be, like, the last kind of line of the interview is, they're like, well, what should we call you? And she says, I'm just a girl. However, you know, you read out the laundry list of accomplishments there at the beginning. Yeah. And, you know, I now feel remarkably unaccomplished by comparison, of course.
As I read them, I thought, give up now.
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, like, well, you know, she doesn't get to review albums on Arena, so I've got that one over on her, fair enough. But I saw Billie Eilish back in 2019 as her star was in the ascendancy. I saw her in London in a 2,000 capacity venue. And by that point, she was already booking arenas. And of course, she would go on to be one of the main stage performers at Electric Picnic that year. But I remember very vividly when she came on stage, there's lots of very, very young people there, about 17 and 18 and so on. And the second that Billie Eilish came on stage, they all held their phones up in unison as if it was planned. It looked like one of those TIFO things that they do in football stadiums. It was incredible. But she is the voice of a generation. She is the voice of Generation Z. And on this one, she is talking about the struggles with fame. She mentioned again in that interview as well, and it's all over this album too, that at her 20th birthday, and she is 22 now, she said she had a terrible time because she realised she had no friends. There's no one that can relate to her. Yeah. And a lot of what she's been doing...
She isn't at a concert holding up her phone with a bundle of her friends all
and
around
what
her.
She's been doing now, and what she is talking about on this album, is trying to come out of that shell and live a quote-unquote normal life, but she can't live a normal life.
Practically impossible. And every lyric that she writes is going to be put under the microscope, and I think possibly none more so than the second track on the album, Lunch. A little bit more synthy and boppy. Listen to the lyrics.
You're just so sweet.
Lunch, the title of the second track on Billie Eilish's new album, Hit Me Hard and Soft. And she's obviously addressing very directly there her sexuality in that particular track, unless it's a matter, unless she's, you know, skirting around the issue. But I don't think she is. But she manages to do this in a way that, I don't know, that others don't. She's open and honest without being in any way exploitative of her own situation.
Absolutely. Like I said, she's very frank. And I do find that listening to her lyrics, like, as Dave said, even reading interviews with her, you do feel that you are getting a very honest portrait from her. And I do find that, like, I really enjoy listening to her albums because I find I get the most out of seeing where she has progressed to and how she is kind of developing as a person. There was those Vanity Fair interviews that came out every year.
Yeah.
And I actually really love her albums for that. For seeing, tracking how she's growing and maturing in
and we can say albums, these are 10 song albums coming in under kind of 40-45 minutes type of thing. It isn't the I'm going to put out all 59 tracks and you can stream whatever one you want. She wants you to listen to the album. Does it merit an album listen and stars, Dave?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, she is the outlier in pop in many respects. I mean, I think today Taylor Swift announced like an expanded edition of her 2-hour 31 track album that came out recently, which is just it's way too much in terms of album bloat. And ahead of this album, Billie Eilish didn't put out any singles because she said she wanted people to experience it in real time as an album, which, you know, in fairness, is how we've been doing it for decades, but the way that generational span has gone, etc., we don't do it so much anymore. This is absolutely deserving of your time. I think it's excellent. It's 4 out of 5 for me. She's booking convention. She's not giving you the easy thing. She's giving you the real thing.
4 out of 5. What are you saying overall, Tara?
I think even sonically, there's such a progression in this, and I really loved the kind of minimalism in it. I loved how she sings a lot more in it, and we're seeing more of that. She's an excellent voice. So for me, it was a 4 as well.
Very solid 4 then for Hit Me Hard and Soft from Billie Eilish. Let's move on to album number 2, Beth Gibbons, and we listen to a track called Rewind.
Gone too deep, gone too far to rewind.
Wonderful rhythms and kind of Spanish and Moorish North African feels to that track from Beth Gibbons and her album Lives Outgrown. I suppose you have, if you talk about Beth Gibbons, you have to talk about Portishead and what she was there. First of all, Zara.
I mean, she was just this enigmatic, incredible voice, as we still hear today. It's still as strong as ever. But what I think is so fascinating about Beth Gibbons and what draws people is how she's one of the few people over 30 years has managed to maintain her elusiveness and actually maintain a private life. Mm. And kind of like the Billie Eilish thing, I love her work for, it's the one time you get to hear what's going on in her life. She famously doesn't do interviews. And with this album here, this is her debut solo album. It was 10 years in the making, and she said that it was like inspired by a lot of goodbyes, grief, motherhood, anxiety, even menopause as well. She said she lost friends, family, and even her former self. So as someone who we don't hear from, but I'm fascinated by, I loved how frank and open she was and how welcoming and generous she was, and all those sweeping instrumentation around it. It's a fascinating album.
And again, 10 tracks, 40-ish minutes, you know, good manners also clearly a part of her musical repertoire. But how oblique is she in the telling of her own story in these lyrics across the 10 tracks, Dave?
It can be quite abstract, but you kind of expect that going into this. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, I found myself kind of surprised. I was like, oh yeah, it is her debut solo album, because you just anticipate that, you know, there could be lots of material out there with Beth Gibbons. I think she's one of the greatest artists that has ever come along, and she's so enigmatic and interesting. And this was recorded, as Zara says, over a period of 10 years, and that's why I will forgive it, my usual bugbear of the most personal album yet thing, because actually, it genuinely is. How oblique and abstract is it? It can be. It's challenging. It's less immediate than the Billie Eilish thing. Although the Billie Eilish album is an interesting contrast, not only because you have two women in the industry and on kind of in different worlds and very much at different ages and different eras and different life under the collar, but neither album is, I guess, immediately rewarding. They're much more concerned with being, you know, allowed to breathe in their own way. And I think, you know, like, you expect this to be challenging. You don't expect it to hold your hand. And, you know, it reminded me more of Bjork than anything, I think, in terms of just kind of creating its own world. I didn't find that to be a barrier, though.
Yeah.
I do think that there are cracks of light in this, despite the heavy subject matter. I mean, it's crucial that Beth Gibbons has said that despite the fact that she went down into the pit, she did see a way back up, and she is once again recapturing herself, which is very important for her.
And musically, has she forged out an identity that moves beyond Portishead? I mean, there's still Portishead elements within it.
I mean, the end of Rewind there kind of takes you back a bit to some of Portishead's.
Yeah, and the final track in the album, Whispering Love, is it, which is this kind of recordery, flutey type of
Lost
folky thing. Yeah,
Lost Changes to me as well sometimes would bring me back to Hunter from their album Third. But actually, beyond the Sonics, like the Sonics here, she's worked with James Ford and Lee Harris, who was in Talk Talk, and I think the three of them together have done something very special and very unique and authentic. And I think, you know, Portishead fans will be looking to hear if there's any kind of leftover Portishead. Sonically, they're bits, but like, I think what's more so is actually her lyrical style, which carries through, and there's a lot of that kind of vulnerability that she has been so excellent at and so almost effortless at doing that's present here. She definitely has her distinct identity in that regard, but I think people coming to this will be pleasantly surprised at just where this album takes you.
All right, you've had a good week at the albums with the headphones. Stars for this one, Zara?
I think this is so intimate, so insightful, and it's a 4.5 for me.
4.5. And Div?
It's a 4 for me. you're right to mention headphones. Both of these albums are headphones albums, because Billie Eilish and Phineas, her brother who produces them, always puts in little kind of hidden things and like subtleties. Same thing going on here. There's an awful lot happening, and you will miss a lot of it on your first few listens, which is part of the replay value and part of the reason to keep going back to it. It is tough. It can be heavy, but it's very rewarding. And yeah, I think we have two excellent albums here. So
an album that you will listen to, and you listen to the album and get more each time. Okay. A very strong praise from both of you there for Beth Gibbons. Lives Outgrown and Billie Eilish Hit Me Hard and Soft. Dave Hanratty and Zara Hedeman are reviewers this evening. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Our broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, who has been with us for a couple of months but is now moving on to pastures new. Good luck in those new pastures, David. And nice to have had you on board for the last while. Back with you on Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creed will be with you after the news.